Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com, that's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, the unique blend of hunting, fishing, wildlife conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle. DSC's Campfires is brought to you by DSC, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy, Hornady, Accurate, Deadly, Dependable, Trigicon, Brilliant Aiming Solutions, Taurus, Award-Winning Pistols and Revolvers, Mossberg, American Built, American Strong, and the Red 55 Winery in Lindale, Texas. Signature wines of Grammy Award-winning country artist Miranda Lambert and owned by Rick and Beverly Lambert.
Welcome to another episode of Campfires with Larry Wysoon, DSC's Campfires, that is. Very proud of the fact that I'm very much involved with DSC and, of course, came off of an absolutely fantastic convention. After the convention, I got an opportunity to spend a little bit of time at the Cotton Ranch there in northeast Texas. I hunted up there while it was snowing and icing and all those other kind of good things, and got a chance to really watch some animals and spend some time learning more and more about those animals as we move into the future, particularly on that individual ranch. That ranch was bought primarily for the fact that it's great in terms of wildlife, tremendous habitat for everything from ducks and water, other waterfowl to fish to, oh my gosh, squirrels and wonderful, wonderful white-tailed deer. And of course, it's also, being close to the Trinity River, has a substantial wild hog population as well, too, which is kind of both a curse and a blessing, and a curse in the fact that we have, and a blessing that we have the opportunity to hunt them there year-round as well, too. That ranch is under the managed land deer permit that Texas Parks and Wildlife Department established some times ago, and it allows the landowner to have hunters on his property, his or her property, through a longer period of time. Usually the MLD season starts with the beginning of bow season at the beginning of October, and it runs through the last day of February. Now, to get under that permit, you have to agree certain things, agreeing being that you have to agree to do habitat changes and habitat improvements, if you will. That can mean brush clearing. It can mean brush sculpting. It can mean adding water. It can be food plots. It can be fertilization of native species and planting different native species. But it also involves harvest with long-term and short-term goals as far as that property is concerned in terms of what you're trying to produce. With so many different ranches, of course, we're trying to grow a little bit better bucks, meaning bigger antlers, bigger bodies. Now, a bigger buck in terms of body and antler is a reflection of the habitat. And if that buck's in good shape and he's growing good antlers, and does it consistently, the herd does, then it tells me that that property is very well managed and kind of needs to where it needs to be. But, you know, there's always room for some improvement. And that's kind of how I got onto this property, is I was invited to come make some evaluations in terms of the habitat and maybe make some suggestions as to what they could do to improve the habitat particularly, and to improve that deer herd. Improving the deer herd, I've kind of figured, meant lowering the population and removing certain bucks and making sure that the does came off when they needed to and all those other kind of good things. And, of course, the habitat changes as well, too. They got in touch with a local wildlife biologist, and as a result, I set up a long-term wildlife management program that I wrote that was approved by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Now, that involves doing surveys as well as of the species and doing surveys in terms of what that deer population is like in any given year. And we're looking at density, we're looking at buck-doe ratios, we're looking at fawn survival rates, we're looking at density, as I mentioned, and adult density as well, too, and at the same time evaluating the deer that are harvested to get a baseline, is to see later on as we do things how things progress. If they're progressing and you're increasing body weights within cohorts or age classes, then you know you're doing well, whether it's does or bucks, either one. Well, the Cotton family does just an absolutely fantastic job in terms of everything. And they're also understanding in that some things you have to be a little bit more patient on. You can't just turn a property around overnight. And even starting with a good property, sometimes to really make the changes that you're hoping in terms of the deer population takes a little while. And they have done just an absolutely fantastic job. It is a low fence property, so deer egress and ingress on the place. And, you know, with that being the case, as you improve the habitat, and that means primarily improving the amount of feed that's available, forage is available on a daily basis, you may attract a bunch of deer, so you may have to take a few more off. And that's one of the beauties of this managed land permit, the MLDP, if you will, that you can start hunting 1st of October, and you hunt through the end of February, as mentioned, and that gives you plenty of time to take the animals off that need to be taken off, and to really get a good handle as to what's there. And, of course, everything that's taken off, you weigh, age, measure antlers, and, again, that's so that you can kind of see the progress that you're making from year to year. With the deer that are there, there were some really good bucks on the property, as they're all throughout that area. It's not just on that particular property, although there's really nice deer there. The area around that part of the Trinity River, which is not too terribly far from, produces some really outstanding deer from time to time, given an opportunity to get some real age on them in the presence of good nutrition. Now, like everywhere else in our part of the world, in the southern probably half of the U.S., deer start maturing body-wise when they get to be 4.5 years of age. Until then, all the bucks are trying to grow body, and body is always going to take precedence over antler development. But once those bodies are fully grown, meaning the long bones and their muscle system and all that, then any food not needed for just pure maintenance can be channeled into the white-tailed deer's antler development. And that's where it becomes really interesting. That's the reason you want to have an abundance, if you can, of 4.5-year-old bucks in your herd, to have a good opportunity to not only harvest a really good buck, but to be a little bit more selective. Now, several years ago, there was a project that was started down in South Texas, and where they caught, tagged, and did DNA on a tremendous number of deer, something in terms of like maybe it was all said and done in the thousands. And to see then once they take a deer later, either caught by the helicopter or if it's taken by a hunter, they could actually go back and get a pretty good idea as to what the parent was like, because they were also taking antler measurements off the bucks that they were catching and then re-releasing. And one of the things they found out was that just because a buck's got a great big set of antlers does not mean he's going to produce offsprings with really big antlers. As a matter of fact, one of their best breeder bucks, if you want to call him that, that consistently produced bucks that scored well over 150 or even higher, was a buck that himself hardly ever grew antlers bigger than about 135 or 138. Something to consider when you these days when you start talking about culling. you know, to me, the genetic side of things is so, there's so many variables within genetics, particularly with the does that you have and the movement that you have with the deer, or the egress and ingress into property. But with me, it's more about mouths to feed. There's only X amount of food in any given time. You want to make certain that that is a daily occurrence where there's more than abundant forage. But that buck that consistently produces relatively small antlers, or he's just a big 6-point or something like that, that buck, or he's got a misshapen antler, maybe it's not a genetic thing, maybe it's just an injury, or where you have that crossover with the hind leg getting injured and the, every year thereafter the opposite antler being deformed. But at the same time, you have to remove a certain number of deer every year to keep that habitat healthy, to make sure that there's food available for everything else that's out there in terms of deer. Well, those are the kind of bucks we try to take off, those that we don't think have the antlers that we're looking for, or misshapen antlers. Not so much from the genetic side. Could they pass those on? It's possible, not very probable, but they're eating the same thing that a really good young buck could be eating out there that could grow some really nice outstanding antlers. And to me, antlers and body, of course, are a reflection of the habitat. When a deer herd's in really good shape as far as the habitat's concerned, and within the capabilities what that habitat can support on the worst of times, you're going to have those bigger antlers, because just there's more than sufficient food out there for on a daily basis. And that's the important thing. So many areas over the country have really high nutrition during the springtime. During the fall and winter, it falters tremendously. And one of the things we've learned is that, doing all kinds of research, is that bucks that develop in those, or grow in those areas, live in those areas where that nutritional level is basically pretty much the same day to day, those are the ones where you, those places where you grow those really, really big antlers kind of thing. So in the instance of the property that we're talking about, very high nutrition during the wintertime. I'm sorry, not during the wintertime, during the springtime when all the things are greening up and a lot of things are there to eat. But during the wintertime, things kind of go kind of south a little bit as far as nutrition, not only in terms of energy, but also in terms of protein and the other things. And research that we did years ago through Texas A&M University down at Kingsville, we found that with antler development and body size, energy is every bit as important as what is protein. So we were looking for ways that we could increase and improve the energy level as well as the protein level during the wintertime, when there's really not a whole lot for those animals there to eat. And one of the things that we're doing there is we're supplementing with whole cottonseed. Now, cottonseed is high in energy because of the oils that it has, because I know you've all heard about cottonseed oil. And at the same time, it's very high in protein because it's very high in nitrogen. And so it is a supplementation. It's not something that they're eating solely. They're eating it, coming by and just taking a nibble of it here and there. But with it done so, they really have made a change in terms of what those deer look like during the winter, and it's particularly coming out of the rut. Those rut bucks get run down, mature bucks particularly, and those, particularly, I guess, the 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, because they tend to do most of the breeding, but they get really run down, and you want to get those repaired very quickly so that that next year they'll have, again, a very decent set of antlers. So that's one of the things that we're doing. But, you know, you got to take off certain bucks, and we've talked about some of the bucks, and we'll take off a number of does, too, based upon the survey, our buck-to-doe ratio, fawn survival rate, the density, and what our goals are in terms of that population, and, again, in terms of total deer density and also buck-doe ratio. So according to the figures that we gather during census, and also during our incidental observations that we take, where we, every time we're in the field, we record what the number of bucks, does, and fawns, and where we can determine what size the bucks are to and what age. That information then we can take, provide it to the local biologist, and then he or she will make recommendations based upon all the things we've mentioned to come up with the number of bucks and the number of does they recommend to be taken off of that property. We had one buck on the property that was hanging out kind of in the very northeast kind of corner of the property. And it's all low fenced, and most of the ranches around and properties around are underneath the same management program as what the Cotton family is. But there's one little area over there that's not. And this is where this particular buck showed up. when I first saw him last year, and he looked like he had a lot of promise. He looked like he had little bumps on 8 point, with little bumps here and there, and I thought, oh my goodness. And he didn't look to be over no more than 4 years old. Maybe could have been five, but he looked like he was four, just looking on body condition and all those other kind of great things. But so this year, we got some trail camera pictures of him, and I was out there in November and hunting in an area kind of the central part of the property, kind of that northeast corner actually, and saw a buck and came in just right at dark. Still legal shooting time. Got all kinds of good looks at him. Really nice, big, wide, tall 8 point kickers on the back on both sides, and long brows, massive. Just one of those really classy looking, what I would call an East Texas buck. Had an opportunity to shoot him, and had I been any other place in that part of the country or even on some of the property I get to hunt elsewhere, there's no question I would have shot him. But my thoughts were, these folks have done really a long, hard job in trying to produce this kind of deer on this property, and really, if anybody shoots him, it ought to be the owner or the owner's son, who you would, both are really great friends and have become great friends thanks to Luke Clayton, who I do so many things with. But my decision was to pass this deer. And that night back in camp, I told David about him. And I said, David, I mentioned earlier when your dad was around that, you know, I couldn't get a shot at this buck. But truth is, I'm not going to lie to you about anything. I could have probably shot this buck. But to me, this is a buck that really you and your dad need to take. He's absolutely gorgeous. I've taken a lot of whitetail deer. I do want to take a buck here, but I really feel like this is one that y'all should take. And that's the reason I passed him. So we knew about the buck at that point. And at that point, too, Mr. Edgar and his stand that he hunts, which is kind of up in that same corner on a big, nice, beautiful food plot, kind of on a hill that grows really good food plot material of all different kinds. They set up a trail camera where there's also a supplementation feeder, if you will, where the cottonseed and some other protein type things are available to them on a 24-hour basis. And you got a trail camera picture of it. So then we had a trail camera picture of him. So then they started hunting him. Every opportunity, they only live about 25 miles or so from the property, and their manager, who's there on a daily basis and kind of keeps watch over the property day and night, is always there. But they started hunting this deer, and the thing about it was, this deer, along with one other one, another big 8 point, basic 8 point, would show up an hour after sunset. I'm sorry, an hour after dark, not sunset, because we can hunt up to a half hour after sunset. And he would show up again when he showed up an hour before the first sign of daylight in the morning. So this deer became pretty much a nocturnal buck. During that time frame when bucks were coming to antlers, David and I tried rattling in that area, rattled up some young bucks, but could not entice this older buck to come out. So anyway, the hunt was on for him. Long story short, we had some very inclement weather right during the time of the DSC convention and hunting or outdoor expo in January. And I spent some time on the property hoping maybe that I could see this buck or at least find out where he was living, and hopefully really find another one as well, too, that we were looking for, just another old 8 point that this buck had a lot of age on him. And I was kind of hunting him as much as I was doing anything, but didn't see either one of those bucks. And it got where we had a tremendous amount of rain, and that rain just kept everybody from going hunting just simply because you couldn't hardly get into the ranch. It had rained so much. So there was about a 2 week period beginning that last part of January. And so I finally got an opportunity to go back there just right before Valentine's Day to go hunt with David and Edgar. There are three food plots in that area where we'd seen this buck. So they'd not been out there at all in the last 2 weeks to hunt, only just kind of check on the property and make sure everything was okay. So we decided to hunt those three different green fields, if you will, hoping that maybe this buck would mess up and come out during daylight hours. And he kind of got to be called, and I don't like naming bucks, but he kind of be gotten known as the never give up buck, because we weren't going to give up on him until he dropped his antlers or before, until the end of February came. Well, that particular afternoon, David sat in the northernmost stand, Mr. Edgar in the central, and I sat in the southern one in that particular area where we'd seen him. And I've not seen anything. I mean, it's one of those gorgeous afternoons, and I got a text from David saying, hey, did he see anything? And I go, no, just a few birds. And a little bit later, I got a text from him to say he was seeing some young bucks. They were coming out. The hunt stand had suggested that at 6 o'clock is when deer would be moving. Well, about almost straight up 6 o'clock, I heard a shot, and I could not tell whether it was Mr. Edgar or David that it shot. And just a few moments later, I got another text from David saying, did you hear it hit? Did you hear the bullet hit? And so I knew that it was him. So immediately I sent him a text and I said, Dave, I had the stand windows closed on the north side. And so I can't really tell. I think maybe I heard it kind of whop afterwards, but I'm not real sure. And he goes, I said, is it the buck that we were after? And he goes, yes, sir, it is. And he said, I shot him and he immediately disappeared. He said, I'm going to go down and look. And he said, I'm almost certain I hit him, but I honestly, I could have missed him. He was shooting a Mossberg Patriot Predator 6.5 PRC with 143 grain Hornady ELDX Precision Hunter that on top with a Trigicon scope. And that combination, I'd seen him shoot it. I mean, it was deadly accurate. I knew the distance that he was shooting, and I didn't think he missed it. So I said, I'll head that way. So I started walking that way, and a little bit later, he and Mr. Edgar picked me up. We drove to where the deer had been standing and looked around, and it was muddy, and it was water everywhere, and you really couldn't see much in terms of tracks. We spent about 45 minutes just kind of close in looking, just trying to see if we could find blood, if we could find anything, any sign that the animal had been hit. Didn't find anything. Went back to camp. David set up a target, and of course, at 100 yards about where the deer was, I mean, the shot was absolutely dead on, perfect. So we knew it wasn't a thing where the bullet had, you know, maybe the bullet went wrong because David pointed at the barrel somewhere, but I didn't think that was the case. He doesn't get excited very often, and I've seen him around hunting situations kind of thing, and so I knew that I just felt like he got him. So I kept telling him, I said, we're going to go out in the morning. We're going to find that deer, and he shows up back at camp the next morning. I said, well, did you sleep very much? And he just kind of looked at me like, no, I probably didn't sleep very much at all thinking about that deer. And I said, well, did you relive that shot a few times? And he said, thousands of times. So he put me in the stand where he hunted the evening before, and he went to the stand where his dad had been hunting and thought, well, if he didn't hit, maybe we'll find him, you know, maybe he'll be here come where kind of thing. So we just, by golly, hope, you know, sat there until, oh goodness, till about 8:30, and about 8:30 he showed up, and we walked down to where we thought the deer had been. Now, as soon as we got down there, I found two little tufts of hair, and I could see that they'd been cut by a bullet. Not like they'd been, you know, there's a fight or, you know, just for whatever reason the hair fell out. It was pretty evident that this buck was shot. And looking at the hair, the color of the hair, it looked like it probably came off of the broad side of that deer where he'd shot. So we started looking, couldn't find any blood right there where the shot was, and just kind of started fanning out with the idea of, we're going to grid this place if we have to, and we're going to spend the morning looking for this deer, because I really felt that deer was laying there somewhere pretty close. I went one way, kind of the way that I thought maybe the deer had gone, and David went the other way, and it wasn't but just a few minutes, and I heard David in a very high-pitched voice, I found him. And so, man, I took off at a run, and sure enough, I get there, and here's this deer laying on the ground that David had shot the evening before. He was about 22 or a little bit better outside, all 10-inch tines, long brow tines, kickers off the back of both the back points, and one brow tine kind of curves outward, and one main beam kind of hooks down, and just an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous deer. Immediately, I run my fingers in the deer's mouth, and back up a little bit. We left the deer with only one concern. We didn't have to be concerned about the meat spoiling, because it was going to be in the high 20s. We did have to worry about coyotes and maybe hogs finding the deer. We did. So long story short there, we found him. When we found him that next morning, thankfully he was still intact. And I ran my fingers in his mouth just to get a just feel of what the teeth might be. And he was a really old deer. I knew that he was going to be at least six, and he could have been even older than that, just a little bit that I could feel. And we would look a little bit later once we did the cape the deer out and took care of the meat. But you talk about a celebration. I was every bit as happy as I think David was, and so very proud that he was able to take this deer after the many days that he'd hunted. And we had kind of teasingly called this the Never Give Up Buck, and that's kind of how we found this buck, is that having looked at around that area for about 45 minutes the afternoon or that evening before in the dark with the light and not finding anything, we could have easily just said, well, I guess she missed him. I guess she got excited and pulled off. But when we went back that next morning and found the hare, there was no question. And so we were not going to give up. We were going to start out just looking very cursory real quickly there in that immediate area where we had not covered the night before. And after that, we were just going to start laying out a grid that was like 100 by 100 yards and just kind of walk that grid and then move over and do another one, then expand that grid to, 200 and 300 yards. Because I really felt like that deer was there, which really kind of proves the fact that, hey, you never give up. If you think you hit him, or even if you think you didn't hit him, you really need to take the time to go look once you take a shot at a deer. Because in this instance, we had a pass-through on this deer. The bullet went kind of quartering it in from the back rib and came out just, right around at the shoulder type of thing. But there was no blood. But these deer are in such great body condition that, among other things, is in the entrance hole got plugged up by fat. The exit hole where it came out, what little blood came out there, hit the water and immediately dissipated to where you couldn't see it. And so we could have just said, hey, we didn't find him the night before. He's still alive, or we didn't get him. So you never, ever really want to give up looking for a deer. And that's kind of the reason that we were able to take that particular deer. And I've written several blogs about him. And if you want to, there's a blog on my www.larryweishuhn.net website that you can go to and read about that deer and see a few more pictures of him. And I've done some writing too for Hornady and internationalsportsman.com and some others about this particular deer, and probably will do a few more articles about him in the future. So you can see some real pictures there if you like. And also shot some segments after we recovered the deer for a Sportsman's Life that we do for Carbon TV that Jeff Rice, Luke Clayton and I co-host. And with that said, you can also likely find that episode on my LarryWysoon.net website as well too. And before too very long, you'll be able to get in touch with me there. And really hope that you will take the time to do so. Just let me know what you're thinking about the podcast, what you think about some of the blogs that are there, and what you think about the show, or if you have some questions that we might relate here later on somewhere through this particular podcast, and just about anything you want to talk about, let me know. And if you don't want to hear about something, tell me that too. So I don't want to hear about that again. So anyway, look forward to hearing from you there in the future. Please go visit the website. You can also buy the two books that we've got out right now, and A Campfire Talk with Luke Clayton, that my co-host on so many different things, and then also the book that I wrote called Deer Addictions. And in the very near future, or say probably in midsummer, I'll have another book or two there that you can get as well too. I'm working on a book on hunting North American big game, and one on hunting international big game. And then Luke Clayton and I are working on one about hunting wild hogs and javelina as well too. So those books are available there, and all those other kind of good things. So really appreciate you being with us around the campfire this morning, and I truly look forward to you being back here with us next week. We'll be back on the guest trail next week with several really most interesting guests. I've got Will Brantley coming up, who does writes for a lot of different publications. And we've got Brian Hoover with the Handgun Group coming in. And we'll get back and visit with Jim Bequette. Jim and I are doing a hunt together here for too very long. And you know, no telling who else will show up here as a guest in the next several weeks. But please join us right here next week around the campfire. Appreciate y'all.
DSC's Campfires has also been brought to you by the Crown Bar in LaGrange, Texas. Habit, our gear, your adventure. The Texas Wildlife Association, Double Nickel Taxidermy, Burnham Brothers Game Calls, and H3 Whitetail Solutions.
I'm Will Cooper, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. If you haven't already, download the free Waypoint TV app to listen to our podcast and watch the original films from Hunt Stand Presents anywhere, anytime, and on any device.
Through the Blackwater Bayous and in the dark Louisiana night floats a duck camp, alive with the sounds of swamp pop and the smells of Cajun cooking. From the Mississippi Delta in Venice to the Cajun prairies of the Southwest, me and the Duck Camp Dinner's crew will be hunting and eating it all.
This is Duck Camp Dinner.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.